Do you know what? We believe all the rhetoric that we've been spouting about the benefits to UK PLC of decarbonising, green jobs, a fitter economy, lower costs to people from a more energy efficient economy. We believe all that, and we believe in it so much we're going to do it anyway. So here's 40% plus from the UK by 2020.
There are just 10 days to go to the start of the United Nations climate talks in Copenhagen. This is the culmination of some 17 years worth of negotiations and discussions where governments from around the world have attempted to come together to solve the existential threat that climate change poses to much of life on Earth. The process has been obscured and obstructed over the years by oil and coal-funded muddying of the science, as well as resistance from vested interests, corporations pushing false solutions, and by governments putting ill-conceived notions of national interest before our collective survival and well-being. Over the last few weeks on the 300 to 350 show, we've been highlighting some of the actions people have been taking and will continue to take to highlight the fact that this process is failing and that rich country governments, not India or China, are the actors with both the power and the responsibility to fix it. This week, I spoke to Ashok Sinha, director of the UK's Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, about the WAVE, the mass demonstration that will be held just before the talks on the 5th of December, when tens of thousands of people from all over the UK will descend on London, sending a message to Parliament that the UK and Europe need to do more, much more than we have said we will do to date, over the days between now and Christmas. So who is Stop Climate Chaos?
Stop Climate Chaos is the UK's largest coalition campaigning on climate change. We've got over 100 members spanning the UK's major environment groups like RSPB, WWF, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, as well as major international development groups like Oxfam, Christian Aid, CAFOD, Tear Fund, faith-based organisations like Islamic Relief, women's groups like Women's Institute, unions like Unison. And we're all united in our belief that we can still take action to keep global warming under 2 degrees C, and that what is required is massive popular pressure to give the government a mandate to act boldly and decisively to achieve that.
And in advance of Copenhagen, you've got this event happening in London, which is kind of a new twist on the idea of a march, I guess. Do you want to say what you've got planned for December the 5th?
Sure. It's actually a whole day of activities. So student groups within our coalition, like People and Planet, are doing various things at different places around the day, sort of photogenic activities like their flash dances and so on. We have an ecumenical church service in the morning that is being led by the Archbishop of Canterbury and organised by Christian Aid CAFOD Operation Noah and so on. There are a number of other events during the course of the day, and indeed the preceding evening, where members of the coalition are holding debates or public meetings, that sort of thing. And the centrepiece is a mass march procession, if you like, that starts from Grosvenor Square at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, assembly from 12, proceeding through the centre of town down through Piccadilly, Trafalgar Square, Whitehall, Westminster, and encircling the Houses of Parliament at 3 o'clock for a mass symbolic moment involving both sides, people on both sides of the river and Lambeth, the Westminster bridges, in a sort of mass encirclement of the Commons and the House of Lords. We hope that what this will be is not only the UK's largest ever campaign event on climate change, but, and it's very important, it's the most diversely attended as well, a hugely pluralistic occasion where we show that people from all walks of life across the whole breadth of the UK are united in demanding better political action and political leadership from the government.
And you're saying that it's starting from Grosvenor Square, that's the site of the US Embassy. Is that a particularly symbolic, do you think?
I think it is, because I'm sure many within the coalition and within the broader movement within which the coalition is situated have been greatly encouraged, let's put it that way, by the positive statements that were made by President Obama before he was elected and subsequently. I think we have all suffered some sense of disappointment in recent times, in recent weeks, when it appears that perhaps for domestic political reasons, maybe it's the sort of the political cycle, legislative cycle in the United States, maybe it's just the extent of the issue, how difficult it is as an issue itself. President Obama seems to have stepped back a little. And I think starting at Grosvenor Square does give us the opportunity to also symbolically say to the United States, well, you know, we've been hoping that the new administration will be a quantum leap forward on the last one, and we still expect great things from them.
Okay, how many people are you expecting? I notice you've got a whole bunch of coaches arranged to get people to London, and there's also some kind of bicycle ride starting from all the way from Bradford.
Yes, well, there are bicycle rides from all over the place. We've got 250 cyclists, I think, in full clerical regalia from the relevant diocese in Bristol. We've got an eight-year-old, long-standing climate change campaigner cycling down from Leeds starting the week before. But, yes, buses and coaches and trains from all over the country. We expect 30 to 40,000 people, but it's very hard to gauge because that's just on the basis of contacts from within our coalition itself. We hope that a lot of members of the public who aren't necessarily actively affiliated to any of our constituent members will also want to come, and that will boost the numbers. But that will easily make it the biggest ever climate change event we've seen in the UK, and as I said before, the most pluralistic and diversely attended.
Do you think that faith in marches, if you like, has been, or interest in marches as a kind of political tactic has been, enthusiasm for that has been dampened by the government's lack of response to the, I can't remember how many million it was now, that marched against the war in Iraq before that was launched. People are suspicious that they'll just get ignored?
I think they are suspicious of that. I think enthusiasm has, as you rightly suggest, been dampened. I mean, I think it was what, depends on your view, it was 1 or 2 million people on that anti-war march. I think what's interesting this time around is that we're not saying that the wave isn't the be-all and end-all of climate change campaigning. Campaigning for a good deal at Copenhagen, campaigning for the UK to meet its moral obligations to slash our emissions far more deeply than we are planning to, and to front up the money that we need to front up, but are not promising as of yet, to support mitigation and adaptation in developing countries. That campaign, whether it's focused on coal-fired power stations, for example, or on international meetings like the G20, that's been going on for months and indeed years and indeed decades. As far as the wave is concerned, we see this as being the culmination of, let's say, 12 months of campaigning since the last COP, where we bring everybody together. People have been running their individual specific campaigns and actions, bring people together in a mass demonstration of unity of purpose and vision and solidarity. And I do think that has resonance. We have to a certain extent, take politicians at face value when they say they need to see massive expressions of support in order to be bolder. I think they should be bolder anyway. But that said, I'm sure massive expressions of public support do help. I think it's also interesting in this regard that we've got a major corporate partner in this respect in the cooperative society, who've decided that they'll give a lot of support to the wave. A lot of co-op members are coming on specially chartered trains and coaches. They'll be helping with the pre-publicity on thewave.org.uk, which is our sort of Mexican wave promotional site. And they have said they're involved precisely because there is a feeling amongst the cooperative society that people just want to get out there and want to make a statement, and the best way of doing that is just to join in with everybody else and march through the streets around Westminster very publicly, in the eyes of the media, in the eyes of all the shoppers and so on, and get their point across ahead of Copenhagen. So the appetite for getting out on the streets, I think, is in a somewhat traditional way, perhaps, is still there and hasn't entirely been killed off by people's disappointments about the anti-war march not having the success that we would have hoped for.
I can't remember if you said at the top when you were talking about Stop Climate Chaos, but the member organisations, they in turn have members accounting to or amassing to somewhere around 11 million, I understand. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you tot up their total supporter bases, I mean, there's going to be a certain amount of overlap as well, which is difficult to assess, but I think around about 11 million is a reasonable figure.
So that's a huge proportion of UK civil society.
It is a huge proportion of UK civil society. I don't think any of our members would say that they can absolutely guarantee the 100% active support of every single one of their supporters. But even if a small fraction of that 11 million are actively supporting their campaigns, which I think that, you know, millions of people are actively supporting the campaigns of our member organisations, I think that represents a powerful force within UK civil society that we're trying to bring to bear. I don't think we'll bring it to bear by having millions of people out on the streets, because that's not always the best way for different people to display their activism and display their concern and apply pressure. So it is about the email campaigns, the demos, the stunts, and all of the different types of campaign work that we undertake. I very much see that the, let's say, 40,000 people on the street at the Wave will be the ambassadors of that wider mass of people.
Mm. And certainly a lot more than the membership of the current membership of the Labour Party, for example.
Yes, indeed. Declining membership, I understand.
Or probably lump all the UK political parties together, and it would certainly outnumber that as well.
Yes, and I think that's because we don't see this as party political issue. If there is one thing that sort of unites everybody, and there are various reasons why people come together on the coalition, it is, if I may put it in these terms, is we consider this to be a moral issue that needs addressing by whoever's in power. And, you know, we want to see less of the party politic and the party bickering and more, I suppose, inspiration from the top and leadership from the top through some of the difficult decisions that we have to take to achieve a low-carbon economy and all the benefits locally, nationally and globally that will be achieved through that. So I'm really pleased at the way that the movement, forget the coalition just a second, just look at the wider movement, is growing and bringing people together. And I'm sure we represent a large proportion of UK society.
And again, the coalition is a large one, and yet you have managed to agree on quite an extensive and fairly radical policy platform. Can you outline very briefly what you're asking the government to do at Copenhagen? What kind of deal you think we should be looking for in Copenhagen?
Sure. Well, I'll just stick to the headlines, because, of course, it's an extremely complicated issue, climate change, and any deal at Copenhagen is going to have measures to cover a variety of areas, whether it's national emissions targets, or whether it's forests or adaptation funding and so on. But just at the headline level, the first thing that we are asking for is a framework of actual real concrete measures that stand us a fighting chance of keeping global warming as far below 2 degrees C as it's possible to achieve. And specifically, that means that the countries like the industrialized West, which have done most to create this problem and have most capacity to reduce their emissions and most obligation to do so, should reduce them by at least 40% compared to 1990 levels by 2020. And I think we also have to recognise that the big industrialising countries have to be reducing their emissions against the business as usual curve by, let's say, 30% by 2020. Secondly, we need to put money on the table. It looks like we'll need at least $150 billion per annum by 2020 at the latest in terms of north-south resource transfer to help developing countries adapt to, but equally important, if more important, mitigate their own future emissions and get onto a low-carbon development path so that it can grow in a low-carbon way. And the third thing is we've got to take action at home to show our good faith. And the most important decision in front of the UK at the moment is in the energy sector. We need to make sure we quit dirty coal and do not build a new generation of coal-fired power stations that do not have fully functioning carbon capture and storage from the outset. Otherwise, we're going to lock in high carbon emissions from the power sector, which is the single biggest source of UK emissions for decades to come, and that will drive a coach and horses through any kind of emissions reduction targets that we set for ourselves. So those are the key three things need to happen. Leadership from the rich countries, money on the table from the rich countries, and domestic action at home to cut emissions by the rich countries like the UK.
Okay, in terms of coal, how does the recent statements, the planning policy statements on the government's intention to fund or allow planning permission for 4 carbon capture and storage coal plants over the next few years, how does that impact? Is that set in stone? Is that a campaign that can still be won now?
I think it is a campaign that can still be won. We are in a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty around CCS. If it works and if it functions, we're going to need it. Countries across the world are going to need it. But nobody's really sure how the technology will operate at scale. Nobody's really sure what the costs are going to be like. The government has signalled that if power stations do not fit CCS, fully functioning CCS, by the early 2020s, they will be required to shut down. Now, on the one hand, we need cast iron policy guarantees from the government this is going to happen, which is why, for example, we're calling for an emissions performance standard to be introduced, limiting the CO2 emissions from any form of power station per unit of output, and for that to be increasingly made tough. But on the other hand, I do think that power companies are going to look at this and say, well, we're making 30, 40, 50 years of investment in an area where the policy environment is going to be very uncertain and we could lose money. So plus, we also know that renewables and energy efficiency are crying out for investment, proven ways to both generate power and save it. So I do think the balance is tilting very heavily in favour of exploiting the things that we do know work, like renewables and energy efficiency, while still testing CCS by all means. And so that means I think we will be able to win the campaign to ensure that we maximise our renewable energy deployment and only deploy new fossil fuel power stations, particularly coal-fired power stations, if CCS is proven.
Okay. I noticed that I'm sure you'd share the assessment that it's the ball is very much in the rich countries' court, and it's their move. They need to put deep cuts on the table and large sums of money for adaptation and low carbon development for poor countries. You share that assessment?
Completely.
Yeah.
And it's the foundation of our pitch into ahead of Copenhagen. If we have to have a fair and equitable deal, and we're only going to get a fair and equitable deal if the rich countries take on their responsibilities to cut their emissions first and fastest, and their moral obligations to provide. I mean, it's compensatory finance, if nothing else, to the world's poorest countries. And I think that's needed just to bring, especially some of the big emitting poor countries, to the table.
And the policy package that the EU has going into the talks is, you point out in your policy paper, dramatically insufficient, and it should be at least 40% with cut by 2020, with the vast majority of these reductions, preferably all of them, happening within the EU.
Yeah.
So I noticed there's an EU Council meeting on the 12th of December, right in the middle of the talks.
Yeah.
Does that mean the EU could up its game and help seal something that is more useful in avoiding dangerous climate change?
It can, of course. And it needs to, because at the moment the EU is... position is an agreed 20% cut by 2030, shifting up to 30% if the US and others join, so we have a global agreement. That still leaves us way short of a 40% plus target. And the EU does formally negotiate as a bloc at the annual climate summit, although, you know, everybody within the EU will be running around in Copenhagen trying to further their diplomacy and trying to get a deal, but formally we negotiate as a bloc. I think every opportunity to knock heads together within the EU should be taken, especially as It is the Monday the 14th, the beginning of the second week of the talks, that the elected representatives arrive. The first part of the talks, of course, are conducted by officials. So that EU meeting could be the last chance for the EU to get its act together and show some real global leadership and take that via the elected representatives into the final phase of the Copenhagen negotiations.
Okay. Probably one final question then. As you say, not very many days left till the conference opens in Copenhagen. What do you think the UK should be doing? Is there anything significant that UK could, you know, wrap it out of a hat style in the next few days that would help move things along?
In a sense, it's not rocket science. I'm looking at Scotland for a second. Our sister organisation, Stop Climate Chaos Scotland, has done well as part of the movement there to work with the Scottish Government, and they've committed to a 42% cut in Scotland in carbon emissions by 2020, which is the top end of the range that was recommended by the Climate Change Committee report, which was authored by Adair Turner.
Are there offsets allowed within that?
No, so far as I know, there aren't offsets allowed within that, but I would have to double check. But we would be certainly cause for some serious concern if there was a wriggle room built into it. So I think the UK as a whole going into this, just like Norway has. Norway said they're going to commit to a 40% cut by 2020. But a big industrial G8 country going into this saying, do you know what? We believe all the rhetoric that we've been spouting about the benefits to UK PLC of decarbonising, green jobs, a fitter economy, lower costs to people from a more energy efficient economy. We believe all that, and we believe in it so much we're going to do it anyway. So here's 40% plus from the UK by 2020, and also saying we do understand we have a moral obligation, as well as it's an issue of self-interest, to front up our share of the money that is needed by developing countries for low carbon development and adaptation. So here it is on the table, ready, and it's there for people to join us so we can build the pot. Both of those two things would make a real difference. A lot of people from sister organisations across the South, through our members, are telling us that would work very well in terms of bringing many countries to the table, particularly from the South. And I think we would signal to the US, you know, play catch up, guys. You know, we believe this stuff. It's important that we make progress, and we're not going to play a game of, you know, I will if you will. We're going to go forward with this agenda unilaterally and try and inspire a deal. I think that would be something really noteworthy and historic in terms of leadership from the UK.
That was Ashok Sinha, director of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, speaking from their office, which sounds like a hive of activity. And more details about the wave and what the coalition are demanding of the UK government and the other rich country governments in Copenhagen can be found at www.stopclimatechaos.org. And to end this week's programme, here's Anna Keenan, one of a number of people taking part in the International Climate Justice Fast. This is an extract from a video diary she recorded 10 days into the fast, where she reflects on the current state of the climate justice movement. For links and references relating to this programme, check out the Climate Radio archive at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.
And what I see has happened in 2009 is an incredible year of movement building. There have been climate camps all over the world. There's been a rise in civil disobedience and direct action against coal. There's been more and more people joining on board and saying, hey, politics, what's going on? Wake up to yourself. More and more people becoming climate change activists. And ever more interlinking globally, it's been absolutely inspiring to see. And from my perspective, the tension has been building and building and building. And so now, on my 24th birthday, I'm 10 days into a hunger strike. And for me, I feel that the tension has been building so much, and we've got, with that tension, a whole lot of energy and a whole lot of opportunity for change that has to be unleashed. And I'm doing everything that I can in undertaking this hunger strike to make that political change happen, and to make it really tip into real physical change and real consciousness change around the world. And I think that the world is ready for that, and I think that the climate change movement is starting to prepare for that and starting to really, you know, not just starting to prepare for it, they've been preparing for it for years, but they're ready to hit the pressure points to get that change to actually happen. No longer just preparing, but to make that change happen. So where does that put us now? We're, you know, 25 days out from COP15 or something like that. And COP15, to me, like, politics has just announced, world leaders have just agreed, we're not going to get a legally binding outcome out of it. It's going to be a politically binding agreement. They've been watering down expectations, doing all of that typical politician stuff. I think that that's disappointing, but on the other hand, it's not entirely surprising either. But it doesn't mean that we can't achieve anything in Copenhagen. I think there always is, and there will always be, time to move and time to change and opportunity to create change. And I hope that the climate movement, and this is certainly what I'll be doing at Copenhagen, I hope that the climate movement takes Copenhagen as an opportunity to express their outrage and to express just how insane the political action is, political inaction is, that we're currently seeing. Political action on climate change, while it's been good and it has been growing over the last few years, as I described, it's nowhere near what is scientifically necessary. And to live on, you know, planet Earth, but to not understand the house rules of planet Earth, you know, Mother Nature's rules that she's set down, to not respect those rules is ridiculous. And if politics isn't going to live within those bounds, then we're in big trouble. And so this is the time, COP15 Copenhagen, no delay for us. If the politicians want to delay, that's fine, but for the climate movement, this is the year and this is the moment, and COP15 is the moment to highlight the insanity of it all and to really help people come on board to the climate movement and to continue pushing for change. We can't give up now. The climate movement has been growing too fast and it's too powerful to fail. I really believe that. I really believe that this climate movement is too powerful and too big and too dedicated to fail. If I didn't have faith that the climate movement would win, I wouldn't be undertaking a hunger strike right now. I'm not doing this out of desperation. I'm doing this out of faith that we will win. And I see Copenhagen as the greatest opportunity for that. So I just urge you in the next 25 days to do everything you can. Organise civil disobedience, join Climate Justice Fast, contact the media, write letters, do whatever you can. You know, organise mass rallies, get out to your parliaments and, you know, do sit-ins in your elected representatives' offices. Tell them what you think. Tell the truth about climate change, because now is the time. Copenhagen presents us with the most amazing opportunity for change that we've ever seen. And even if it's not signed into a legally binding agreement, the opportunity for change is still there.